I'll call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employee Retirement Association for August 13, 2014, to order.
Roll call?
Yeah, let's start with a roll call.
Okay, Gordon Ford?
Here.
Maria DeAnda?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Here.
Jason Gordo?
Here.
Mike Lynch?
He's outside.
Jim DeMartini?
Here.
He's on the phone.
Jeff Grover? Michael O'Neill?
Here.
Donna Riley? Joan Clendenon?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay, any announcements?
Yes, there's one announcement regarding the July 22nd meeting minutes on, on item 8A, excuse me, the motion was made by Darren Garrett and should say seconded by Jason Gordo. The minutes said Jeff Grover, but he left prior to that motion being passed, and the initials were the same. So we will correct it to Jason Gordo.
I think they are one and the same.
Yeah.
Only one is
you know, here. We email each other back and forth, and always say JG at the end of it.
So now I have
did
to
I write this
Jeff.
Email? I wrote this email.
That was my announcement.
Any other announcements? Okay, public comment. Matters of jurisdiction of the board may be addressed by the general public before and during the regular agenda. However, the California law prohibits the board from taking action on anything which is not on the posted agenda unless it is deemed an emergency by the board of retirement. Any member of the public wishing to address the board during the open public, during the public comment period shall be permitted to be heard once up to 3 minutes. Please complete a public comment form and give it to the chair of the board. Any person wishing to make a presentation to the board must submit the presentation in written form with copies furnished to all board members. Presentations are limited to 3 minutes. So we'll do the public comment period. Anybody from the public want to make comments? Okay. Consent items. Anybody wish to pull a consent item?
I move to approve.
Second.
Moved and second to approve consent items. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. We move on to item 6, Executive Director, Monthly Staff Report.
Okay. This is our monthly staff report where we let the board know what staff has been working on over the last month. And I'll tell you, the biggest thing that staff has been involved with or working on this past month has just been getting the regular workload out. Right now we're down 2.5 bodies due to medical leave, mostly on the benefit side. And as you may know, Louisiana is leaving us, and actually I forgot to say something in the announcements about that. So let me back up for a second, please. And go back into announcements just very quickly here. I apologize, but I wanted to let you all know that this is Liliana's last day at Stan Sarah. She has decided to spend some more time with her family and maybe try some other ventures over the next few months. And Liliana has been a wonderful staff member to Stan Sarah. She's got pretty much the most ambition I've seen out of anybody in my career. And she's a very intelligent person as well. And she was a wonderful addition to Stan Sarah. And she is really, truly going to be missed. I can say that from the bottom of my heart. And if you're all so inclined, if you could stick around for a little while after the board meeting, we're going to have a quick send away for Louisiana.
I'm
going to
miss you,
Louisiana.
Thank you. I will miss everybody, too.
And you're going to take a deferred retirement.
We've been talking about that.
I've submitted my paperwork so I can have time to consider all my options.
Well, I can tell you from my experience, don't take the money. Leave it there.
Does that mean you took your money?
I took $300. It cost me $5,000 to get it back.
Good advice. So anyway, getting back to agenda item 6A, We've been focusing mostly this last month on just getting the word out. We are, again, 2.5 bodies down due to extended medical leaves. Louisiana's leaving us today. And to use an old cliche, the hits just keep on coming because Don Lee just got chose to sit on a 2-month trial. Yes. So we're really rocking and rolling right now. So we're going to be... We've taken some steps already. We're going to be hiring temporary staff to fill in during this time. We've also given a lot of the disability function over to Ted. Normally, staff does a lot of the summarizing and organizing of the disability material. I don't feel that we have the time to be able to do that ourselves right now, so we've given that off to Ted. And again, we're filling in the gaps with temp help right now. But it looks like we're going to be shorthanded for at least another month or two, possibly. And so that's really what we've been dealing with for the most part. We've also...
You couldn't pull any punches with the DA?
Well, I thought about it. I was thinking of calling Darren, but...
Darren can fix it. If he had solved the crime, he's...
We,
It didn't happen in Houston, Mike.
Oh, that's
right. The city of Modesto.
We've also, as you know, we were right, not in the middle. We had just begun the data auditing project that we thought was going to take 2 years. We've also put that on hold. We really had to prioritize what our workload over the last month, and we need to get the basic core function of Stansera out, and that's paying benefits, and that's really what we're focusing on right now, unfortunately, and nothing else. It'll get better. It's just going to be a matter of time. In the meantime, we still have been working on our long-term strategic realignment for the organization. We've been meeting with staff on a regular basis to get an idea of what their job duties are and how changes in their job duty might affect us going forward. We're looking at a lot of different scenarios right now in terms of what we're going to need over the next 10 years, and we will be bringing in an agenda item to you in the next month or two that's going to lay out Stansera's long-term needs, and it's also going to attempt to put a price on it too, so you can get an idea of what we're going to be looking at over the next 10 years. And then finally, we've also been preparing for the financial audit, which is what the Investment Governance Committee just met earlier today. And do you want to say a few words about where we are in that process?
On the audit?
Yes.
We met for the entrance conference today, and everything's a go. The auditors are going to be here starting Monday. They'll be here for 3 weeks. We're hoping to have the entire process complete by the end of October. So the Northern Trust Bank transition is complete. It's finished. We received the audited year-end reports, and they're all reconciled and balanced already. Very smooth, no real major hiccups at all. Interest has been posted to member accounts, and statements were sent out last month to all active members. Contributions for the fiscal year 2014 have been posted, and all cash has been reconciled. The document in your board packets stated that the 2014 earnings have been calculated and allocated. That is actually in the process of being done. Not everything is in financially yet, so we can't do the allocation until that happens. Staff is working diligently to complete the year-end processes necessary for the audit. We received a laundry list of 74 items from the auditors. Most of these items need to be completed and uploaded for the auditor's availability by the time they get here Monday. So we're diligently working on that. And this year we have to implement a new GASB statement, GASB 67. That's going to add some complexity to this process. And staff has been coordinating with the actuary and the employers for the information that the auditors have requested, because the auditors have additional work to do due to the new GASB pronouncements. That's where we are with the audit.
And the bottom line on the cost is closer to $70,000 than $38,000.
Yes.
Right?
That's true.
Due to the new implementation of GASB pronouncements.
We underestimated the amount we were going to have to spend with the auditors to manufacture the new reports for GASB 67 and 68. I think we had estimated it was going to be about 15,000, and it's turning out to be more like around 30,000. That's okay. We save in other areas, so we're good. All right. I think we're done.
Okay. Item B.
So this is the funding of the $5,000 retiree burial allowance. Just to give you a refresher, that the $5,000 burial allowance is essentially a life insurance policy that pays a lump sum to the family of a retiree who passes. It's essentially, the lump sum is $5,000, of course. It essentially is meant to pay burial allowances, funeral costs, and so forth. In the past, we've been valuing this benefit outside of the normal actuarial process. That's just the way it's been done for years, I've been told. But a couple months ago, the actuary called and says, you know, since we're going to have to account for this in the new GASB 67 and 68 requirements, it would be a lot easier for us to simply just put that liability into the normal actuarial valuation process. I'm bringing this to you for your approval, but just to give you a little more information on this benefit and how it would be handled in the valuation. Right now, the actuary has told us there's about $6.2 million in liability. That's essentially off the books, off the pension balance sheet right now. And we have about $5.6 million in the non-valuation reserves. That's essentially meant to pay that benefit over the course of time.
Dedicated
to this. So if we move the $6.2 million liability into the normal actuarial valuation process and move the $5.6 million sitting in the non-valuation reserves into the process as well, you're going to introduce about a $1.2 million unfunded liability. 1.2 million unfunded liability. 6.8 minus 5.6 is 1.2. So if you take that and amortize it the way we're amortizing all unfunded liability in the plan, that's essentially going to create an increase in the employer rate of about 0.04%. So it's pretty much inconsequential in terms of the effect on the employer rate.
Which translates into how many dollars?
Let's see. Probably $50,000. It's pretty nominal in terms of the county's overall budget. It's pretty meaningless. There's no legal restrictions. 37 Act doesn't say how we have to fund this benefit. They don't say where it needs to be funded. And also a final note is that the board did in 2012 declare in an open meeting that this benefit is vested. So there's no question in the future, just because this benefit is in a non-valuation reserve, that it's not going to be paid. It's been declared vested, and so there's really nothing that we're losing or necessarily gaining here. It's going to be a little easier to administer because the actuary won't have to do an independent calculation of the liability. He just lumps it in with all the other pension benefits. And we will simply just move that off valuation reserve into the valuation reserve on the accounting side, and it'll be pretty much transparent. And so what we're asking you today is staff's recommendation is, as of June 30th, 2014, to go ahead and include the liability from this burial allowance into the annual actuarial valuation and pay the benefit from the valuation reserves. We also need your approval to modify the excess earnings policy to allocate earnings pretty much the exact same way that we allocate earnings to all other valuation reserves. Right now, what we do is the death benefit, for some reason, has a priority in the hierarchy of how we allocate excess earnings. That comes first, essentially. So now we're just going to, when we allocate earnings, we're just going to give it the same interest rate as everything else in the valuation reserve. It's just going to be treated as a normal valuation reserve. So we're also asking you to allow us to modify the excess earnings policy to include that.
That can all be done in one motion?
Yeah, I would say if you understand what I just said, you can just motion staff's recommendation and look for a second. But I think Joan has a question.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago with either Sackers or CRCEA, they were talking about converting this to an actual insurance policy. providing for an actual insurance policy rather than the, the dollars.
Right.
Whatever happened to that?
I don't know, but I can tell you that essentially that's all this is an insurance policy, an insurance benefit. But from our perspective, this is such a small benefit, and we don't have any profit motivation or profit margin. There would be no reason to farm this type of benefit out to anybody. We can, we could administer this benefit cheaper than anybody else can.
Has it been, you know, when the discussion about that came up, it seemed to be that it would benefit.
Take it off the books, maybe?
Pardon me?
Take it off the books, maybe?
Yeah.
It could. We wouldn't have to administer it, pay the benefit. And also, my guess would be, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, but my guess would be is that it was something, a scheme devised to pool all the death benefit for all the systems and not just individually, because it doesn't seem...
It may have been. Yeah. I don't remember the details. Yeah. I just remember that we addressed this in legislative committee and we were dealing with it.
Okay. Is the money lumped into the same account today? It just accounted for in a different bucket?
Exactly.
So we've been investing in it.
It's absolutely. This is really not a big thing.
Not a big.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make them... I'll make a motion to adopt staff's recommendation with respect to item 6B.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay.
All right.
Education presentation.
Can you flip the lights there, Maria? So just a little bit of background here. Last November at a SACRS meeting, I don't know if you guys remember, but I can't think of the gentleman's name. He's on options analysis on CNBC. He's got the ponytail. Mm-hmm. Najarian?
Mm-hmm.
He spoke at the SACRS conference in the fall last year. And he mentioned, he talked for a few minutes about portfolio insurance. And he was kind of questioning, he explained it in a very at a very high level. And he was kind of wondering why more institutional funds don't at least look at this concept in terms of funding their pension benefits. And I've also had a board member or two, you know, ask about the concept as well. So this is mainly an educational session. It's meant to just give you an idea of what portfolio insurance is and how hedging assets are used to alter the return distribution of your portfolio. Okay, so like I said, three of the objectives we want to try to accomplish today are is to understand at a very, very high level how equity options work, understand the theory behind portfolio insurance, and above all, we want to gauge the board's interest in using hedging assets like this to control risk in the portfolio. And so at the end of the day, we'll be asking you if this is a concept that you want to explore further and bring in more professional people in here to discuss this further. I got to tell you right now is that I understand the theory behind this. I've studied it two times in my life, but I don't understand the execution. I've never did anything like this, and if the board is comfortable with this strategy, which is what we're doing today, then we will bring in people who know a lot more about this concept than I do. Again, this is just theoretical, because that's all I understand is the theory behind this.
Theory versus practice.
Pardon me?
Theory versus practice.
Yeah, and my hunch, and Jason may be able to tell me, my hunch is that execution is a lot different than theory. But at least theory will give us an idea, what an idea of the concept itself is what we'd be doing if we did this. So portfolio insurance definition is essentially a way to guard against extreme events that can cripple a portfolio. We saw this happen in 2008 and 2009. When StanSara's portfolio lost almost 40% of its value in that two-year period. So portfolio insurance is something that would guard against an event like that. It's, I don't think you would buy portfolio insurance to guard against 0% returns or negative 2 or 3% returns. I think you would engage in portfolio insurance to guard against those really extreme scenarios. And essentially, the concept is that you would use hedging assets. Today, we'll talk about options, but there are other types of assets that one could use to do this. But you use hedging assets to eliminate those extreme bad scenarios. And you do this by giving up favorable returns on the upside. So for example, and this is just an arbitrary sentence here, for example, you eliminate returns less than negative 15% by giving up returns greater than 13%. I totally made those numbers up, so don't read anything into the distribution of returns at this point in time, okay? Do not read. That's what I'm saying. Practice, if we do bring somebody in here, they'll show us what those actual return distributions could be given our situation. So what you see today, the graphs and the charts are all good, but the numbers are essentially contrived. I don't know what the actual return distributions would be based on the price of options in today's world. So, but again, the theory is good. The graphs really give a good idea of what we're attempting to accomplish. So options at their basic form are essentially an insurance policy. The buyer pays a premium and he receives a payout as some event happens. At its core, those are what options are. Financial options come in many forms, and they essentially insure against a drop in price or even allow one to participate in the upward movement in the price of some asset. There are a lot of examples, and there are a lot of interesting examples of options. Price of corn, the price of milk, essentially. Equities, which is what we're going to talk about. There's even weather options, and they would, if we go to the next page, like a weather option, the insured would get paid if the annual rainfall in a specific region drops below 15 inches. There are actually options that actually do that. And I would imagine, and I don't know any, but I would imagine that some farmers actually use these types of options to guard against bad returns on their crops. I do know that I have an uncle that has a dairy out in Ceres, and he definitely uses milk futures. Options futures, he uses milk futures to guard against the price of milk in his business. So farmers around here do actually use these types of things. Just a few words on option terminology. A strike price is the price or event at which the payment is triggered. So if we were looking at weather futures, that the 15 inches of rain or below would be the strike price. If rain is below 15 inches, then the insured would get paid. And so the 15 inches would be the strike price. If you were looking at a stock option, the strike price would be the price at which if the stock price fell below, you would get paid. And we'll talk about that more. It gets a lot simpler as we go. The option price is simply the price that you pay for the option. And then the expiration date is the term that you're insured. Options, you can buy an option for one day. You can buy an option for 1 hour. You can buy an option for 6 months. You can buy an option for 2 years. The term of the options are all over the place. And of course, the longer the term is, the more expensive the option would be. Just analogous to an insurance premium. There's two types of options. There's call options and put options. I'm sure you've all heard of those terms before. Both options, the buyer pays an upfront premium to receive the coverage. But in a call option, the buyer receives a payout if and only if the stock price ends up greater than that strike price. So the weather analogy would be the buyer, well, that would be for a put option. So we're talking about a call option here. Let's look at a stock price. So the buyer would receive a payout if he bought an option with a strike price of 100 and the stock price ended up at 110. So he would get the difference between the strike price and the stock price. His money, his revenue would be $10.
Plus what he paid for the option.
Yes, plus what he paid for the option. A put option would be, you could create a good analogy using the weather example. If the annual average rainfall in a certain region in California is 14 inches, that's 1 inch below the strike price, then the buyer would get a payout. So this example kind of just, actually what Jason just said. So in this call option example, the buyer, let's assume, I made these up again, so the buyer buys an option for $8.50 on one share of Apple with a strike price of 100. This example, even though it doesn't say it, the current value today of the stock is 100. That's what I assume in my example.
So the option pays off if Apple stock actually goes above $100. And the option expires worthless if the Apple stock ends up at or below $100. And so you can see the payout. So if the future price of Apple ended up at $80, it's finishing below the strike price, so the option is worthless. Same for 100. You can see, though, your profit is negative 850, which is the cost of the option. That's what it costs to buy the insurance. If the future price of Apple ends up at 120 with a strike price of 100, you earn $20 minus the cost of the option. So in this case, you earn $11.50. And so on and so forth. So theoretically, on a call option, the purchaser of a call option theoretically has potential for infinite gains. If the stock price went to $1 million, which would never happen, but if it went to $1 million, you earn your $999,000 or $999,900 minus your $850 for your option price. So anyway, theoretically, the profits are infinite when you hold a long position in a call option.
So in this example, you're going to earn your $20 and you get the $11.50. So it's
you'll get the $20 when the option expires, but you had paid $8.50 to get the insurance when you opened up the position.
So if you hadn't had an option, you would have made $20.
Exactly.
If you had an option, you made $11.50.
If you hadn't had the option and you owned the stock, you would have earned $20.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right.
Say that again.
It cost you 12 times more to buy the stock than
right.
the option.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
You would have earned $20 had you owned the stock.
Without
the option. But in this case, you're buying the call option naked. That's what this example is.
But so you don't own it yet.
You don't own it yet. That's right. That's right.
But on the other side, if you it had gone to 80 or fallen to 80, then you would have only lost
$8.50
instead
of $20.
Exactly.
So how is this different than those companies that bet on, you know, the housing going up versus housing going down in 2008?
So, this is basically an insurance policy. So this kind of sets you up at the very beginning. What those people actually did was they were more of a futures type contract. So they entered into contracts with people that said, if a certain amount of my buyers default, then I'm going to get paid. So in some sense, that was an insurance policy, but essentially there wasn't enough collateral that backed up those insurance policies. These are different in the sense that these are 100% collateralized, whether you're the buyer or the seller of the option. So you don't have that situation here. And I also don't think you would have that situation today with those types of derivatives that were issued during 2008, 2009.
So what's the collateral?
The collateral, in this case, if you are an option writer, is essentially you hold, and we're going to get into this, you actually hold the security in your portfolio. So you actually have that security in your portfolio. So you can give away all the returns above the strike price because you're getting those returns, essentially.
So, Mike, on the example, you know, the thing to think about here is there's always a winner and there's always a loser in an option contract. So no matter what happens, somebody's going to have profited and somebody's going to have lost money on the contract.
Right, I get it.
If you own the stock, let's say you owned 1,000 shares of Apple stock at $100 and you sold the strike price at $100 for $8.50, you're going to get, how many shares did I say, 100 or 1,000?
100.
Okay. So you're going to get $850 in your account that's yours. You get to keep that $850. And you're
even though I don't own any.
No, you own
no,
the stock.
You own,
okay,
yeah.
That's because I'm the seller. Of
yeah,
the
exactly.
Option.
Yeah, you sold me 100
so
shares of Apple for $8.50. I rented your stock.
Okay.
And at some point in the future, 6 months from now, let's say, I think Apple's going to be worth $110, and you think it's going to be worth $108.50 or less. If it's worth $108.50 or less, you won, because you got $8.50 plus the $100 for the stock. If it's worth more than $108.50 6 months from now, I won, because I'm going to call your stock.
What if it goes to $80?
Then you really won, because you got $8.50 from me. I get nothing, because the clock expired. The time was up, right? The contract date, we started today, and this is the contract date in the future, 6 months from now. So when I buy it from you for $850, there's a date in the future in which I have to either execute or let it go. So if it goes along and the stock is $80 at the contract date, you have an $80 stock.
So we're betting
times
on
100.
The market. We're not
we're betting
anything,
against each other.
We're betting on the market.
We're betting against each other.
But I mean, the Sancerra would be my yes. options betting against the market. We're not
or
buying,
betting with
we're not
the
buying
market.
Anything. We're not buying any companies. We're not buying any stocks. We're not buying any.
What you would be doing, you
we're,
would be
we're gambling.
You would be buying exposure to that stock without actually having to purchase the stock outright.
Or hedging stock that. You
or
own.
Hedging. Well, this will all. We're going to talk about this. Okay. We're getting a tad ahead of ourselves here.
The one thing I don't. The term portfolio insurance. That's where I have a hard time with this because this is an investment strategy.
It is.
It's a hedging strategy.
It is.
So it's not like buying catastrophic insurance, right? If there's a fire in your house, you bought insurance, and the insurance company is going to come fix your house.
It's like buying tail insurance. You know what tail insurance is?
I do.
It's exactly what it is buying tail insurance. You want to chop off that left tail of the distribution, the bad part of the distribution. And we'll show that here. We should actually show pictures of the distribution.
That's the thing with catastrophic insurance. You're still going to pay something, but you're not going to pay everything. You're not going to lose everything. And that's really is what the
that's
bottom
exactly
line
what this is.
Is.
Okay.
Because we wouldn't use this strategy all the time. We would just use it if we felt that there was something we needed to protect against.
Well, we're protecting about the drops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the bad drops. The drops that could take our funded ratio from 80% down to 50% in one fell swoop. That's kind of what you're guarding against here.
But Rick, here, I'm sorry, but I don't believe in that there are easy answers to a lot of these things. What happened in 2008 it was that nobody had the money, and that's why everything fell. All the guarantees fell.
Right.
Everything failed.
Right.
Why wouldn't it, if we had
because,
that kind of a drop, how does
right.
this protect us?
Because if we bought a call option, we can only buy a call option from somebody that actually holds the stock in their portfolio. So,
okay, so they give you the stock that's not worth it.
They give us the gain. No. This is a call option. So if the stock went really high up in price and we bought this call option from them, since they own that stock, they're earning those great returns on that stock.
Right.
They would have to give us those great returns on that stock.
But if there's a market-wide collapse, everyone's got the same problem. What are they going to pay us with?
Okay. That's a very good question. No, that's a very good question. You're starting to get into the math of things. And the way put options are constructed and the people who write put options, essentially the way they put them together, they always have the capacity to make those payments if the stock goes down. They write these on exchanges, am I right? They write these on exchanges where the exchanges won't let them sell these types of options unless they have the collateral to back them up.
So there's naked and covered calls
right.
and puts. You would only engage in a covered put or covered call strategy where, again, you own the stock and you're betting that it's either going to go flat or down, but you have maybe a low cost basis in the stock and selling it would trigger a taxable event to you. That's one reason people would do this on your side. You're the owner of the stock. Another reason is to spice the dividend, right? Because if you get $850 in this example and it expires worthless, you got to keep your stock and you got this dividend that you created for yourself of $850. But you have to own the stock in order for me to buy that contract in this example, this covered example. So if the stock went to the moon, it went to $200, you put your stock on the note, on the line that said, I'm willing to give it up for $108.50. Even though it's worth $200, I lost, and you get my stock. And we only pay $100 for the stock. I think that's a piece that we've maybe forgotten along the way.
We're going to get to it. We're really getting way ahead of ourselves here.
You put to me the stock for $100 a share.
It's an interesting topic.
So you have to sell it to me for $100 now.
No, I got it. I get that.
Let me tell you something on the insurance side. When you buy a put option from somebody, the option writers don't make their money on the price of the stock going up or going down. They make their money on what they charge to sell that option. When somebody writes a put option, they most of the time, big writers of put options, and I don't want to confuse anybody, but they enter into offsetting positions in the futures market. So if the stock does go down and they have to pay us money, they're going to score on a futures contract that they entered on the other side with some other buyer. Everybody essentially insures their positions in these markets when they do these types of things. And all option writers, they profit not on the movement of the stock. They profit on the fact that they're getting those upfront premiums. That's where they all profit. They don't make money whether the stock goes up or down because, as Jason said, they write covered calls.
It's almost like the insurer, if you will, is covered. Yeah, exactly.
They are. Everybody's covered on these things. Everybody puts up the proper collateral. Nobody is going to put themselves out there and create a situation where they're going to be ruined. Nobody's going to write put or call options and watch the stock go to infinity and be ruined. They take offsetting hedging positions in their positions in case something like that happens.
That's just the seller of the insurance.
The seller, correct. Correct. We're just talking about the seller.
The buyers have...
Buyers have no risk other than the option price. None. That's all they have to put up. That's all they can lose.
Thank you.
So this is the payout pattern for a call option, for the buyer of a call option. So remember that the strike price was 100. So the break-even point in this example is 108.50, because that's what the person had to pay for the option. So the stock price has to go above 108.50 before it becomes valuable to the buyer of the call option. And you can see that if the stock finishes below $100, then the most that the buyer is going to be out is the cost of the option. So he gets all the upside potential and none of the downside potential from actually going in and buying a stock. So it's kind of a lucrative situation if you actually think about it. You can get exposure to a stock, like Jason said, with paying a fraction of the price, and you can earn all the upside with no downside risk.
I don't know, I keep thinking that somewhere there's a perfect storm where everybody loses.
This is like, you know,
well, half the people are going to lose.
I'm
saying that there could be a perfect storm where everybody loses.
The only way everybody loses is if people don't make good on these,
exactly.
The people that sell the options. But again, you can't really do that in today's world. You have to have these either offsetting positions or the assets as collateral.
I don't know. I keep thinking of Bernie Madoff.
Well,
just remember, I didn't have him.
I just keep thinking of the credit default swap. Everyone thought everything was guaranteed, and it turned out that the guarantee was worthless.
These guys, they're not living in a vacuum. I mean, they're going to have an idea or an opinion and on what the value of that stock is, and that 850 could vary.
The people that write them? You're talking about the people that write them?
Yeah.
This may not make any sense to you, but I'm going to say anyway, the people that write these options don't care about volatility, don't care about what the stock price is, because they're going to make money no matter what the stock does.
But wouldn't the 850, wouldn't that charge change?
Yes,
to the way
definitely.
Felt the value of
absolutely.
I mean, if it was Apple and they think Apple's coming out with a new phone and it's going to go up, then I want $25.
They don't set. They don't set the price of the options. There's a highly complex theoretical mathematical model that sets the price of these options based on volatility. What you just said: the more volatility is, the higher the option price.
Okay.
Absolutely. But they don't set the price. The price is mathematically defined.
The theoretical thing is
by the market.
By the market, by volatility and interest rates. Strike
if
price.
If you bought options on GE, it would not cost you very much at all per
exactly.
share.
Exactly.
But if
not
you
volatile.
Bought it on Tesla stock, you're going to pay a lot of money for the right to potentially buy Tesla in the future.
Yep. There's more. The more volatility there is, and potential volatility is the price of the stock, the higher the option is, which makes sense. Because you've got more of a chance for that stock to act or move for or against you in that period of time.
Why wouldn't we just buy the stock? If we think it's going to go up, why don't we just buy the stock?
We'll show you. We do own the stock. What we're trying to do is guard against a drop in price of that stock.
That's your whole story.
All right. So a put option is...
Come on, Paul Harvey.
So the buyer, or you buy an option for $8.50. I just chose the same option price. On one share of Apple stock with a strike price of 100. The option pays off now if Apple stock goes below $100. So now we're looking at a true insurance policy on a stock that you may hold in your portfolio. And then the option is worthless if Apple stock ends up at or above 100. And so you can see the profit pattern here. It's pretty much symmetric with the call option. It's just flip-flopped. It's the other way around. So you can see that if you actually held a share of Apple stock at $100 and it went down to 80, you'd get a $20 payment. So you're insuring that downside, you see, less the cost of the option. Put options to me are a little easier to understand in terms of our business. But we need to understand call options to be able to understand portfolio insurance. And so there's the payout pattern for the buyer of a put. And so you could see as the future price of Apple stock decreases, the payout increases. So portfolio insurance, institutional funds sometimes use portfolio insurance strategies to hedge their risk or change the outcome of their potential future returns. And the way they do that is they sell a call option on their equity portfolio and they buy a put option on their equity portfolio. And most people talk about, when they talk about selling an option, they talk about, it's called writing an option, just if you've heard that term before.
So do they do that simultaneously?
They do it simultaneously. And we're going to see now how the combination of holding the stock...
Isn't that sort of like betting on red and black at the same time at the roulette table?
Yes, exactly. That's a very good analogy. You're hedging your bet. That's exactly what this is all about, is hedging your bet.
But you end up with nothing.
Nah, you don't.
So how different would it get green? How different is it, Rick, from the broker telling us, buy this stock, and then the broker telling someone else, take an option up here because this stock is going down?
Well, yeah, that's not what's happening here. That's unscrupulous of what's happening
in
your example.
Yeah.
No, that's not what's happening.
This is not a lily white industry.
Right. But we're taking control by the way we sell a call option and buy a put option. We're taking control of where our returns are going to fit in between. In other words, let's just go on. All these questions are going to be answered. You guys are asking good questions, but you're getting way ahead of the...
When I saw this is what you were talking about today, I thought, wow.
Well, I have to put this out there. We got to put this out there because this is a way to guard against bad things. So now, okay, so remember when we talked about a call option and this is the payout pattern for a buyer of a call option? A seller of a call option has essentially a transposed graph here. We just flipped that around the x-axis. And so a seller of a call option has a payout pattern like that. And so somebody might ask, okay, so why would a pension plan actually sell a call option when we could have potentially infinite losses? Well, the reason is because we actually hold the stock in our portfolio, like we talked about earlier. So if I take the red line here is the profit pattern for simply holding the stock itself, just like what we have in our portfolio. The stock goes up by a dollar, we earn a dollar. The stock drops by a dollar, we lose a dollar. So if we take that payout pattern in the red and we add it to selling the call option, we add the green line to the red line, we end up getting the purple line. So that would be our payout pattern for holding one share of Apple stock. So what you see here is that we've lowered the downside risk a little bit, and we've lowered the downside risk essentially by the premium we earn by selling the call option. But we're giving up all potential upside by holding that Apple stock, because all that upside goes to the buyer of the call option. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, why would we do that? That doesn't make any sense here, because we're giving up a lot of upside potential here for just a little bit of downside protection. The reason is because the third part of the story is here, you also buy a put option along with selling a call and buying a put. And what you end up having is a return distribution like this. So if you look at the buyer of the put option, you add this payout pattern to the purple one, what you're doing is you are taking this downside portion of the purple line and you're kinking it up. You're buying put options and you eliminate that downside risk by buying the put options. And what you end up is with a payout pattern like this. So you've created, by selling the call, you're giving away some of your upside position, your upside potential, and by buying the put, you're limiting your downside risk right here. And what you've done is you've altered the distribution to get your returns into this area right here by doing that. Okay? So, all right, let's go on. So why wouldn't pensions just buy the put options only and continue to give themselves the entire upside potential? Well, put options, if you don't have, if you don't sell the call options along with it, put options can become very expensive. And like Michael was saying, they get very expensive when volatility is very high. There also may not be enough put option writers out there for somebody with a portfolio the size of Stansera. And also, by just using put options, you have to use a lower discount rate. Essentially, you have to remove the price of the put options in the expected return that you're going to get on your portfolio. So using just simply buying put options is really not a viable option for a pension plan. So in the portfolio insurance strategy, the pension plan buys the put options to hedge its downside risk, and then it sells call options on its portfolio. And the income from the sale of the calls offsets the price of the puts, so you don't have to lower your discount rate. But in exchange, the price is cheaper, but you're going to give up some of the upside in exchange. So the problem, there's still some problems. There still may be a limited number of buyers and sellers of options for a portfolio the size of Stansera's. And because of that, we may only be able to apply it to a smaller portion of the portfolio. And so, as a consequence, we wouldn't necessarily be able to hedge all the risk in our portfolio. So what I want to So what I want to show you now is what the resulting return distributions would be by using a portfolio insurance strategy. So this chart is essentially a normal distribution of Stansera's actual returns right now, what we could expect to see in the future. And so the way to read this bar here is that there is about a 13% probability that our returns next year are going to be somewhere between 7.4% and 11.4%. And this is actually from our distribution based on our mean and risk measure of our portfolio. This also says that there is a probably, I think it was a 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 chance that our returns next year will be negative 6 or greater. That's all the probability that's clustered on the left side of the distribution here. It also says that there's probably about a 1 in 4, 1 in 5 chance that our returns are going to be greater than 19% next year. So this is a probability distribution on our returns based on the way we currently invest. So, yes?
When you were talking about puts and calls, you were talking about stock. Individual stocks.
Right.
Here you're talking about the portfolio.
Exactly.
So, in the end, it's the cumulative return on the stocks. I don't get
so,
it.
I mean, we wouldn't buy puts and calls or sell puts and calls on every stock in the portfolio.
No, I understand that, but we've been talking about individual stocks. Now we're talking about the whole portfolio.
Right.
Wasn't there, I don't know, I must have missed something.
Well, the only reason I talk about individual stocks is because it's easier to understand the concept when you're just talking about one stock. When you would employ a strategy like that, you would do it on an index. You would buy puts and calls on an index that closely matched the return distribution of our portfolio.
Okay.
So
that's the bridge.
So we have money market, or we have managers who are buying and selling stock on our behalf and hopefully making good calls. And we're going to have another set of managers who are going to buy and sell these on the same stock.
So if that's what if we want more information on this and that's what we choose to do, we would have our custodian bank run this program for us.
And but are they selling these puts and calls on the same stock that our managers are selling and trading daily?
Of course,
daily?
Yes. I know what you're thinking, but that's part of their business, is to bring buyer and seller together. For whatever reason, the buyer and seller, for whatever reason the buyer and sellers need.
Somebody
are the same managers doing both these, or we have a different set of managers?
Oh, I would say definitely different sets of managers. I have a feeling they have a dedicated team just to managing programs like this, and that's all they would do.
So we would tell our custodial bank that we want to enter into this situation, and we would give them a range or the index that we wanted to participate in.
Yeah, in other words, how much return do you want to give up on the upside for how much insurance you want on the downside? And their task would be to go form a portfolio that would give us that return distribution like we saw. Mm-hmm. In fact, this is a good example. Depending on the strike prices of the call and puts, you can alter this. You can actually raise this bar up, bring that bar down, and so forth. So it depends on your appetite for risk and how tight or how wide you want that potential return pattern here.
Does the price change accordingly?
Absolutely.
And how much the insurance costs?
Absolutely.
So your graph is, for lack of a better word, profit after you pay for the insurance.
Yes. So, okay, I want to show you now what happens if you just buy a put option on your portfolio. So essentially what you're doing is, when you just buy a put, you're essentially hedging your downside risk. You're not giving away any upside potential. It's expensive. But what you're doing is you're chopping off all these bad scenarios here, all the probability in these bad scenarios, and you're clumping it into this part of the distribution right here. So what you see is, yes, you have a greater potential for a return between negative 14 and negative 10, but you've chopped off all the bad returns on the left side of that. That's essentially reducing your tail risk, if you've ever had that term. You're eliminating your tail risk in your distribution.
Sounds like CYA.
Essentially. This is an expensive strategy, though, because this only entails you actually buying the put and not getting any income or giving up any upside potential.
But in a sense, that's the concept of insurance, to eliminate
Absolutely.
The bad.
Right.
But I see that the mean return has also dropped.
Mean return has dropped. That's a good observation because of the price of the option. Remember we talked about you have to use a lower discount rate because you're shelling out money of your portfolio to buy the options.
You're paying for insurance.
Okay, so now if we add selling a call option to it, the distribution changes even more. And so what you're doing is you're taking all the good returns here and you're lumping them into one. One of the interesting things about this, though, is you have a very high probability of earning a return between 7.4 and 11.4%. Because all these returns that you would have gotten here, 19.4, 23.3, they're all lumped into this right here because you're giving away all those returns to the person that bought the call option from you. That makes sense? So you can see how buying puts and selling calls alters your return distribution and it what gives you the concept behind portfolio insurance.
Which ultimately, although there's still more risk on the downside, In this example, ultimately what we're going to get, no more, no less than 7.75, basically covering our liabilities.
We'll cover our liabilities. Well, in this case, you can see you can get returns up to 11.4%. But the point is that the strike prices that you enter into with the put options and the call options dictate what your return distribution is. You could actually push this out to the right a little more and push this out to the left a little more, and you'll get less downside protection, but you'll get more on the upside. So again, I made these up, but theoretically, this is the concept behind this portfolio insurance. How you structure your return distributions is up to you, and also what the market is offering in terms of option prices.
I object to the concept of insurance on the second half. Insurance is a protection against an adverse event.
Right.
That's the concept of insurance. That's essentially the first part of what you're saying. Taking your long-term profits and bring them in is an investment strategy, but I wouldn't call it insurance.
So you're talking about this right here.
Yeah, that's not really what I call insurance because it's not insuring against an adverse effect. It's not what we normally think is the term insurance.
Well, it is insuring still on the left. You've chopped off the left tail.
you've just done it by giving away.
Well, as you say, the first half, what you were talking about, is an insurance concept.
Realize here, though, look at this. The mean return in this strategy is still 7.5%.
Well, I say it's an investment strategy. I'm not arguing that.
Okay.
But it's, the term insurance is to insure against something.
Right.
Hey, Rick,
insuring against that you're going to get a high return is kind of an
concept. You're insuring against a catastrophic.
That one right there is insurance.
But so is this one.
No.
It's just that you're using the right side to pay for the left side insurance.
No.
And you're paying, and you're paying
the terms
less,
wrong.
But you're paying less for your insurance in the end.
Right.
Going this way.
You're using a different strategy to pay for insurance. Yes, I have no problem.
Okay.
But it's not insurance.
Hey, Rick, is this new?
What you're saying?
No, this is not new.
How long have people been doing this?
This concept has been around for as long as I can remember, as long as I was studying actuarial and CFA exams.
So how'd they do in 2008?
Well, this strategy would have worked very well in 2008.
Is there any reports on that or studies or anything?
No, but I mean, if we could use this as an example, we could say we would have limited our losses to 8.5% as opposed to 30%. However, think about the last 2 years. If we had used this strategy, we would not have got 14.6%. We would not have got 18.3% the last 2 years, and we would not have been number three in the nation in terms of portfolio returns. But we wouldn't have suffered the losses that we did in 2008 and 2009 if we had this employed this strategy.
Rick,
it's a give and take, Mike. I mean,
Rick, in theory. Then could you move these down to
totally.
A central axis where you could guarantee a return?
You could do whatever you want here. You could adjust these however you can create the distribution that you want, however way you want it, but you're going to give up and get something in return. There's no free lunch here.
So right, but you could work yourself into an area where you guarantee yourself a 4% return or 5%.
Oh, yeah, you could close it. Actually, what you could do is you could sell a call with a strike of 100, buy a put with a strike of 100, you could pretty much guarantee your return, whatever that is. So
two people of equal.
Actually, it'd be zero, wouldn't it?
Well, there's going to be arbitrage opportunities, right?
Yes, but theoretically, they should be
sold. One of them's going to cost more than the other.
So
It depends. So that's what this other slide talks about. Theoretically, you could create a priceless hedge. Okay, but you'd have to accept the return distribution that went along with that priceless hedge.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You could actually, but if you wanted to pay a little bit more, you could actually move this in a little closer, chop off more of that tail and pay a little more, but it's going to cost. Then you'd find your discount rate dropping a little bit. But theoretically, there has to be a priceless hedge that exists out there where the price you sell the call options is the same price that you have to pay to buy the put options. But that dictates what your return distribution would be. You can't have it both ways. Does that make sense, Mike?
Yeah. Which Mike are you talking about?
That Mike. So in this situation, your portfolio performance, there is no difference as long as your normal portfolio returns are between negative 12 and 11.4%. You wouldn't have to pay anymore. You wouldn't have to give up anything. Your returns would be the same had you not even implemented a portfolio insurance strategy. The only thing that changes is when the returns are either less than negative 12%, then your losses are capped, or if they're greater than 11.4%.
Now, I don't know if you have or not, but could you put this in context, for example, of what our past 20-year returns have been?
I could.
But you have the highs and the lows. What would it have averaged out?
I could. I could do it, though, only theoretically because, I can't go back and look at what the option prices were 5-10 years ago.
Right.
Well, are there studies that show how, I mean, if this was a pretty good hedge in 2008? I mean,
there is.
Can we have a couple? Can we look at some of those?
Absolutely. And if we bring somebody who knows a heck of a lot more about this than I do, they will be able to answer and give you better examples. I'm just doing this just to show you the concept. I don't even know if these even make really truly any sense. All I do know is that that's the potential outcome we're looking at here.
Well, it seems to me that if you had a tool that protect against 2008 type events, every pension fund in the country would have embraced it.
So here's the problem. And this is one of the questions we need the board to weigh in on before we even go any farther. Would you guys be willing to give up that right, that upside potential? Would you be willing to accept an 11.4% return when your neighbor to the north and your neighbor to the south are making 20%?
Absolutely not.
That's
not
a good question.
Not even a question in my mind.
Well, would you? What about would, well, would you be? No, how would you feel though if your return was negative 8.5% and your neighbors to the north and the south were negative 40%?
But over time, absolutely, those things are going to happen.
They are going to happen. Remember, Gordon, what
I
our goal is.
I understand exactly what you're saying.
We're looking to earn 7.75%.
I understand. But what you're trying to do is get a safe world with no risk. Can I understand that?
Well, we're trying
that's the concept of insurance.
Are you against insurance?
No. I'm just saying that that's not insurance. That's not even close
to
insurance.
Well, I would disagree. I think it totally is insurance.
Okay, well.
But there still is risk. You have a risk of this distribution. You still don't know what your returns are going to be. You just know that they're going to fall within a tighter range.
Sure, it's like how much heartburn and anxiety can you manage? Can you stand? Can you stand the 20% fall and the 20%
right.
high? Or would you rather be in right. that 8 to 8% or 8 to 12% range?
Right.
It's just, you know, your anxiety level.
Can you stand an 8% return, say, 2 or 3 years in a row, where your neighbors are earning 40% a year?
Correct. That's a good question.
That's a very tough question.
It is a tough question.
Well, that's why I want to look back at that, say, an example 20-year period of time
mm-hmm.
where we've had it, experienced those ups and lows, and see what might it have looked like
the
if we had had
definitely.
This type
definitely.
Of...
That's a good
option.
And then how would it look in the press?
That gets down
we're getting 8%
managing
in,
your cash flow.
You know,
yeah, this is
absolutely.
This
that's a tough pill to swallow.
Rick, let me ask you this.
Yes.
When you talk about this or when you think about it in theory and your investment thesis, is it that you would do this for 100% of the risk piece of the portfolio? Or would you...
So you want my personal opinion?
I mean, what
yes.
What would staff recommend to the board?
Right now, I would recommend that if you want to explore this option further, we get somebody else in here. Personally, I don't know if I would do something like this. I truly don't. I don't know if I would want to give up that much upside potential for the downside hedging.
You've got to watch that.
The biggest thing that I'm doing for you here today is letting you know that there are options. And when the markets do go south on us, just so we all know that there were potential ways to protect against those things.
Now,
so, but I think it's too,
well,
it's
you need
too
to
complicated, and it's too expensive
but
to do
you
something.
Protect against a loss by limiting your winnings.
Yep.
But our job, our primary function, is to ensure the payment of benefits into the future. And we have determined that in order to do that, we need to have a return of 7.5% every year, 7.75. Anyways, and our upside will be 11.4. The downside, eventually what you see is a middle ground, the ups and the downs, to get us exactly right there. So, I mean, I personally, I tend to be a little bit more of a gambler in that regard. But if we were being that prudent manager of funds, that's exactly where we would want to be at 7.75. Nothing less, nothing more, unless our actuaries told us that we needed to do that.
Well, but my question is, do you need to do something like this to do that?
Well, other than that, you go into fixed, well,
well no,
fixed.
you could get out.
You just accept whatever happens.
Of course.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though. But it's a, in a way, it's a gamble. This is you take the gambling away, you take the risk.
Right.
It doesn't take it away, it just reduces it.
It's
it.
A way
right.
to alter.
We're in the market now, and we're gambling.
It's a way to alter your return distribution.
Again,
going
back to the catastrophic insurance. If I have a hospital bill that's $1 million, and that's exactly what I had in my savings account, I would lose everything. But because I have catastrophic insurance, I'm going to pay $50,000. It's going to cost me $50,000, but I still have $950,000 in savings.
So I guess my feeling is that if you don't want to take the regular risk distribution that's associated with investing 60 to 70% equity, then you probably shouldn't be investing in 60 to 70% equities. By investing in the portfolio that we are investing in, we are implicitly saying that we accept this return distribution that goes along with it. So if we don't want to, if we want something that's a little more predictable, maybe we shouldn't be investing in as much equities as we are. That's my personal take on it.
One other thing you haven't talked about, which is leverage.
There's most no leverage involved here.
That's wrong.
But no, there's not. There's no, leverage I'll involved explain. Here.
Most of these strategies are used with leverage. If you get into leverage funds and that kind of stuff, it depends on how you define leverage.
I mean, you're taking leverage on one side, but you're getting it on the other side.
I understand.
The net position is no leverage. It's a neutral proposition.
Okay.
If so you take one side of this, it's a different ballgame.
So going back to that, I can't remember, John, I think you asked the question, or maybe it was Jason, how much of our investments would we go into this with? We don't necessarily have to do all of it.
No.
To mitigate some of those potential losses.
So that's a good point, Maria. You could actually take our distribution here, and if you wanted to, probably pretty cheaply, you could just chop off
yes.
this and this at the ends and still keep a wide distribution.
Well, you could even just chop off one end if you want.
Well, again.
Have you looked at any long short strategies?
What's that?
Long short strategies.
I know what a long short strategy is.
I mean, that's basically.
Pretty much.
A way to get the same thing on a much less expensive platform, and you would do it with just a percentage of the portfolio, you know, 5, 10, 15%.
Yes.
And that studies have shown, I'm not professing this to be expert testimony, but studies have shown that if you use a hedging strategy, you will smooth the volatility of a portfolio and give you a more consistent, predictable return over time.
Mm-hmm.
But I would not be a fan of, we have 60% in equities, so we're going to cover that whole thing with a hedging strategy.
I wouldn't either. Why would you be in equities if you want to hedge the distribution?
But I will tell you, the last 5 years, it was painful if you were in a hedging strategy.
But this type of hedging strategy, though, doesn't necessarily produce winners and losers. It just alters your distribution.
Well, what would happen, though, over the last 5 years, if you look at your cumulative return and then annualize it, you were much higher than 7.75.
Right, I agree with you.
So you had a lot of pain in the last five.
But you're predicating your statement on, based on the fact you know what happened the last 5 years.
Well, what I'm saying is, if we have another five-year period like that, I would sure be kicking myself behind walking out of here every month.
Definitely.
Saying, we just gave up a whole bunch of juice that was
easy to get.
That's why I said, let's go back 20 years where we've had really good years, and we obviously have had very bad years, to see what it would look like to give us a better, more realistic view based on our past experience.
And the other thing is, we're now putting non-correlated assets together with all of this, lending and real estate, it's non-public traded, the railroad stuff, the airplanes, all that stuff is not related and correlated to the stock market. So that in itself is a hedging strategy.
It is.
That will help smooth the volatility and make a more consistent return.
It is, but one of the things that came out of 2008, 2009 is that all correlations started trending towards one between asset classes, and that was the thing that really drove portfolio values down, is that there was no safe place, no safe diversification strategy to be into when that happened, because all correlations went to one.
Well, they trended towards
one. They trended to one, right. So again, I'm not sitting here before you advocating the strategy. I'm sitting here trying to educate you that there are hedging tools available, and you could implement these strategies over very short periods of time, 2 or 3 months, or very long periods of time. So if there is a situation where you feel the markets are getting ready to implode, you can overlay your portfolio returns with a strategy like this for a short period of time.
I would simply add that any time you're talking about options, you're dealing with leverage.
On one side of the equation.
I don't care how sides you want to take it. Options are, by their definition, able to make a large movement with leverage.
But in this case, your
you can have offsetting leverage and argue that.
Right. And that's what this
fine.
Is here.
What but you're saying is I'll leverage here, I'll leverage there, and they'll offset.
Right.
But you're dealing with leverage.
You're dealing with leverage, but we're looking at the sum of the leverage components in this
right.
strategy.
And that's where it gets back to Mike's point, that if it works, it's fine. If it doesn't, you've got yourself leveraged all over.
My concern, Rick, is I know I'm naive about a lot of this, but I like it when we invest in stuff. We invest in real estate. That's a building. That's a road. That's something. We have that airplane. We have part of the airplane. Stock market can go to heck, and we still have part of an airplane.
An asset.
Okay? And we own stock. If that goes down, we still own part of a company. I don't know what we own here. You got to convince me that we own something.
Well, you still hang on to your portfolio. You would still own your portfolio. It's just you're buying and selling insurance on the rate of movement of your portfolio. So you still completely 100% own your portfolio.
Right, no, I understand that, but it's I kind of thought we were doing that with our when we bought the stuff.
We are. Again, my thought is why would you even want to hedge or insure your portfolio? Why would you buy a portfolio with 60% equities if you didn't want to turn around and hedge it? That just doesn't make any sense to me.
I totally support.
Same thing, extremes out of the equation.
Yeah, but I mean, if that were the case, why wouldn't I do this? Why wouldn't I buy equities and just buy the put options?
Because it's expensive.
It's expensive.
Yes.
Just remind me, what percentage of our portfolio is currently in the...
About $1.1
billion. It's about 60%.
60?
60, yeah. But it's spread over other things, you know, international, all sorts of stuff.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So it's not one place.
Okay. We're thinking that this may be a way of protecting ourselves against future losses. I may misunderstand things, but as I understand, the growth in the market now is mostly the result of the fact that that's the only place anybody can make any money now because interest rates are so low and the economy is growing so slowly. That's correct,
mm-hmm.
right? So if that's true, then when the economy starts growing and interest rates go up, the market's got to go down because people have someplace else to put their money.
There is a loose correlation there, but that's not necessarily true all the time.
Okay. So it's not inevitable that the market has to go down.
No.
There's a debate on that.
Pardon me?
Job.
There's people on both sides of that argument.
Job, I can make the guarantee word only in this sentence. The market will go up and the market will go down.
Yes.
How much, I have no idea. But it's going to do both things.
Or win.
Okay. You're a big help.
And maybe you're
Well, I mean, she's like, it's never going to go down. So.
I think we should insure money, take money.
But
we talked at one point.
That when people have someplace else to put their money.
People rarely make good decisions when it comes to their money.
That's a good
I
statement.
I agree with that.
Like, institutions tend to do it well.
No, what?
True.
What I was going to say, I think we should insure our money as we can. I think we should take some of it off the table to ensure future beneficiary payouts. We talked about that some time ago. Obviously, the obvious way of doing that is long-term bonds if the interest rates change. I'm open to other vehicles for it. I don't. This is not quite the kind of vehicle I had in mind, but I'll certainly welcome future discussions on this and other ways to do that.
Now,
I think we should take some of the money off the table.
We're still on course to institute a glide path sometime next year in 2015. Interest rates I don't see trending up dramatically in the next year or two, so it's going to be something that's we're just going to be watching and hoping that interest rates do go up, and I think that's a very smart move. Let's wait and see where interest rates go, and if they do start to trend up, I think that's where we take advantage and start pulling risk off the table. Again, I'm not here to advocate this strategy. I want you all to know that. I'm just here to educate you on the strategy and let you know that there are options out there I don't mean options. There's options for you to do stuff. In fact, this can be done with things other than options. It can be done with futures. There's even ways to do it with swaps. I've talked to our custodial bank before I actually put this together, and so they kind of helped me to understand this a little more.
I think first we need to make a decision. Do we want to look at any type of vehicle that would, to use your term, hedge a severe drop in our equities?
Insure us in some way.
Okay.
Protect us.
Yeah, sure.
And that's the question.
And that's yes or no.
That's the question. Do we want to explore
and my
this?
Answer for you, at least from my personal standpoint, is options are one of the worst. There are a lot of ways to do it. I don't like
them. If you look at them in isolation, I would agree. But if you look at them in terms of an overall portfolio strategy, I would strongly disagree with that.
Okay.
So again, the question is, do we want to protect against low market risk?
Which is what we've done through diversification.
Right. But I think, Rick, you stated earlier that we have 68% of our fund in equities, which are much more volatile than, say...
Right.
You know, something else.
So here's a question. Are you comfortable with the fact that there's a 1 in 5 chance that our returns could be less than zero?
But wasn't that the argument of everything we've done so far in putting things in other areas?
Right. But
is
I
to
guess,
avoid that?
I guess what I'm saying is by diversification, we are well diversified, like we all agree.
And so we're reducing some of that.
We still have a distribution of returns that gives us a 1 in 5 shot of having a return less than zero.
What you're saying is that our concept of offsetting didn't work.
No, it's diversified to the greatest extent possible, but you're never going to diversify your portfolio to...
Or said another way, everything could go bad at the same time, is what you're saying. Everything we put it in.
Like it did.
Like it
did. Rick, I totally support diversification. I think you should look at every option, bring them back, let us all discuss them, including this one.
Okay.
And we can move on, but let's...
I agree.
Okay.
What does Paul think?
Paul is kind of wishy-washy on this topic, to be honest with you. So he doesn't really say one way or the other whether he thinks this is a good idea or not. But I've told him that I was going to bring this, you know, forward.
Has SIS ever gotten into it?
What's that?
Has SIS ever gotten into it?
I don't know. It's a good question. He wasn't definitive in whether he... thinks this is a good strategy or not. That's the best answer I can give you.
I get the feeling in some areas he doesn't want to go into. He's not familiar with.
I think that Paul tends to hedge his bets once in a while when it comes to investment advice.
Well, what I don't understand, if this was such a great tool in 2008, why everyone is like hesitant now?
Well, that hesitant to use it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I have a feeling that before 2008, everybody was fat and happy, and we didn't think anything like this was going to happen. And then after 2008-9 hit, then all of a sudden these types of topics became more relevant and they were discussed more.
Yeah.
And we also remember we have short memories as human beings.
Yeah.
We've been fat and happy for the last 5 years. That doesn't mean
we have convenient memories.
Yeah.
So I see it as that we have two things going on. One's, like Mike says, is indemnify some of our portfolio, you know,
right.
What we're gonna be. And as Maria says, you know, try to maximize our returns, but being as safe and secure as we can be, given the box that we're in, and the playground we have to play in.
So like continue to diversify, and then again, as Mike Lynch was saying, yep. As interest rates do start to trend up, I think that's the opportunity to start pulling some of the risk off the table.
Exactly.
I agree.
From my perspective, that's
based on our short-term and long-term cash flows, which is the study you're working on.
Yeah.
And instead of insurance, let's call it immunizing the fund. How's that sound?
That's immunizing. This is insurance, but what we're talking about down the road is immunizing. Okay, good. So you would like to... learn more about this topic?
For education.
Okay. Well, it'll probably be a few months down the road, probably not until next year. But
after Christmas.
A Christmas present.
All right.
Yes.
Okay. When you get fully staffed.
Yeah, right. All right. Thank you.
Okay, where are we?
Auxiliary.
don't know, it's kind of nice discussing things in the dark.
Yeah, sometimes we do feel.
I've been up since 2:30.
Okay.
Might fall asleep.
We're to closed session.
And no coffee.
So I can get a motion to go into closed session.
I make a motion to move into closed session.
Second.
Okay, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All righty. We move on to members forum.
That's
okay. I have nothing.
That's okay.
Maria?
I have nothing.
Nothing.
I don't have anything.
It's always a separate file.
Costa Rica was fun.
All right. That's good.
Yeah. Nothing to add.
I just said, you guys might recall the Transparency California request, public records request some months ago, a year ago. It's now online. And you can go look at all the different amounts of money that everyone's getting paid.
Oh, goody.
For all the public agencies.
In our county?
No, it's all over.
All over.
And what's interesting is Merced counties, they don't list the names. Ours has the names. Merced doesn't have names.
What, they give titles or something? What, do they do, give titles instead or something?
Titles, yeah.
Oh, okay.
If you go to flashreport.com and go to June 18th, it's all there.
Flash report?
Yeah, but then you get tagged by the Tea Party in your adult.
Oh my God! Rick and Amy?
It's the opposite of
you would just die.
One thing.
I get the Tea Party.
I'm going to be on vacation the next week of the board meeting, so I will not be here the 26th, the investment meetings of August.
Will you have any staff here?
Depends if they stay. Oh!
I just need to get somebody to handle my legal issues there, Darren.
I'll do your briefing on this thing. We'll adjourn the meeting.